You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds just poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Massive protests are expected in response to the Quebec summit. The U.S. and Canadian governments have established a pattern during the past year of criminalizing dissent, fortifying their meeting places against protests, even engaging in preemptive arrests of activists. Increasing police violence has also accompanied the protests. The government corporate alliance has done just about everything but desist from their agenda, which, as you have heard, is to rid the world of the excess democracy that interferes with corporate profits. Government spokespeople in the U.S. and Canada have asserted that these countries are democracies and citizens have the right to protest if they do it peacefully. But what do they mean by peacefully? One might argue that their use of peaceful is as a code word for a protest that can be ignored, a protest that will not impact the outcome. Impacting the outcome is the right, and our next speaker argues, the duty of citizens at this juncture. Professor Bob Everton of the BC Latin American Congress.
Mass direct action has a very long history. As a matter of fact, it goes back to the beginning of recorded history that we can find in some of the earliest writings that have been able to be deciphered in Sumer, fairly clear indications that established that that society in its earliest, as all the societies surrounding it to the best of our knowledge, was one that made decisions democratically. At least it made decisions within a large assembly of all the citizens that lived in each city-state. We have early indications that what happened was those assemblies in times of crisis would elect a leader momentarily. They, in effect, would elect a king for a limited time. And as the centuries went on, many of those kings became entrenched and didn't give up the power that was voted to them in the moment of crisis. And as the centuries turned into millennia, we see that they established dynasties. But throughout all this time, both in Sumer and Mesopotamia, entrenched in Hebrew practice through the Phoenicians, we find that the people in those societies always retained the right to intervene, to call an assembly of their citizens, and to say to any ruler that was not ruling in their benefit that that ruler is ousted. Very long established practice from some of the earliest moments that we have in recorded history indicate that that is our history. That is a practice which was one of a right of rebellion. When there is a government, even under governments that were not elected, we as a people have determined that we have a right and we have practiced that right throughout history on many occasions. Now, I'm not here to talk about today yet the right of rebellion. I am talking, however, because that is a form of direct action. I am talking about that along the way, as our governments And particularly, I think, around the FDA, we have to point a finger and expose the incredible role of both the Canadian and the American governments. That today, where we have governments that are mounting a whole new regime of rights, that is eliminating and eradicating rights that we thought that we had entrenched in institutions and provisions in this society, but that are being eradicated, some of which haven't been acted on yet. We're still waiting to act on many of the democratic rights we have to actually create a democratic society. But those rights are being eliminated and replaced by corporate rights. And as that happens, there is a responsibility that we have, if we want to live in a democratic society, to stand up and to say very specifically, around very specific changes, that no, that is not acceptable, period. The whole notion of mass direct action that we've seen related to globalization is a very concrete history. It didn't just kind of pop up out of nowhere. It didn't just all of a sudden emerge in the streets of Seattle because. No, there was a process out of which that evolved. And the process goes back, very concretely goes back to a conference that the Zapatistas held in 1996, 2 years after NAFTA came into effect and the Zapatistas made themselves known, when they had created a certain amount of political and social space within which they could call other people to come to assemblies and to discuss matters to try to figure out how we can actually confront what is undermining our societies today. One of those that they called was an international encounter, 1976. It was the Intercontinental Gathering Against Neoliberalism and for Humanity. And in the last couple of months, they switched it around because you got to put your positives out front first, but it often goes by that name still, Against Neoliberalism and for Humanity. There were some 3,000, 3,500 people from outside Mexico that attended. It was a very important meeting in terms of people sharing notes, coming together around this issue in a significant and militant way for the first time. But Chiapas is a war zone. So at the end of the 6 days of discussions that took place there in different locations, it was agreed that we need to have another such international meeting, intercontinental meeting. But the second one for 1997 was called in Europe. It was held in Spain. And at the end of that particular meeting, there were some couple of dozen individuals from 7, 8, or 9, I forget exactly how many organizations that hung around and talked about the need to create something else. And over the course of a couple days, they hammered out what it was that they wanted to create. Something that wasn't going to call people together each year to talk about critiques of capitalism and to analyze the economic and the political and the social. Yes, that would continue to go on. But there was a lot of headway that was already made in those initial meetings. Instead, they wanted to create something that would be based on action, direct action. And they did. So they formed the nucleus with four hallmarks of what would be the basis of unity for those that wanted to participate. And among the initial organizations that made this up was the Sandinista Workers' Federation, the Zapatistas from Mexico, the MST, the Movement of Landless Peasants from Brazil, Reclaim the Streets, Fair Play Europe, the Philippine Peasants Movement, which got together in February of 1998 in Geneva and constituted the PGA, People's Global Action. The full title that they had for the PGA was People's Global Action Against, quote, Free, unquote, Trade and the World Trade Organization, because they understood back then what it was that we would come to see the World Trade Organization to be as it unfolded. The first mass direct action that they called for was on May the 18th in 1998 at the second ministerial conference that was held for the WTO in Geneva. And on that occasion, they called out 10,000 people to the streets of Geneva. But in preparation for this, they had not only called for mass direct action against the ministerial conference that was taking place, they called for people around the world that were concerned of these events to participate as well. Because what they called was the first day of global action. And we've seen many since that time. Those involved on May the 18th in 98 weren't only the 10,000 people in the streets of Geneva that totally overwhelmed the officials, both within the WTO as well as the police in the streets. If people think that they were caught by surprise in Seattle, November 30th, 1999, they were nowhere near as caught by surprise as they were for the second ministerial. On that occasion, you found on that day 50,000 people called by MOSEP in Nigeria that met for the Ogoni nation. You had 50,000 people from the MST that converged on Brasilia in Brazil from four different directions, all raising the same issues. You had 100,000 people in Hyderabad, India. Now, we didn't hear about this if you read the local newspaper. If you know anything about it, it's because you found the information online. Well, the next global day of action was called for June the 16th, 1999, for the G8 meeting in Cologne. Again, we saw the same thing take place. We saw 122 cities around this planet in 42 different countries reach out in actions of civil disobedience, take to the streets, and to say no. We saw the same thing, and many of us are familiar with it, with respect to Seattle. Now, with respect to the FTAA, we have another so-called free trade agreement that hopefully, after the different workshops that were offered yesterday, everyone here is well apprised of what exactly the FTAA is and what it intends on doing. It is the granddaddy, so far, of the free trade agreements. All the different conventions that they wanted to introduce to the other free trade agreements or to the MAI and they were unable to do, they've got embedded in this one, and they still want more. This is a text that was drafted a couple years ago after they called for the corporations in this country to come together to a conference in Toronto to put out their wish list on what would they like if they were to redesign society. That wish list is the starting point from which these negotiations are taking place. And we, as citizens of the host country, are not even allowed to know what the text is. Is that not shameful? How dare they do that and claim that in any way they are democratic? They are implementing an entire shift, a new regime of rights, of corporate rights, that are undermining and eventually eliminating individual and collective rights that you and I have, some of which we have had for hundreds of years, and which we have been struggling for decades to actually implement more and more, and yet they are being eroded in the way to be cast off entirely in favor of a regime of corporate rights. They have chosen to redesign the institutions and practices of this society, and they have not chosen to do so around the values of social justice, of increasing democracy, of eliminating poverty, of improving our welfare. Instead, they have done it around the value of ensuring a maximization of profit for monopoly capital. Not even for all capitalists, but just for the largest segments that are out there. They are redesigning our society along that model. How dare they? They do not have the mandate to do that. They have never presented that as the option that they would fulfill if they were elected. They have never informed us that this is what they intend on doing. They have never gotten our consent to do that. And yet they're going to tear gas us if we stand up and make them accountable for the atrocities that they are committing and the rights that they are undermining in our society. The text is a text that must be made public. There is nothing more basic that we could ask of a government that claims to be negotiating on our behalf, to at least inform us what it is that they are pushing for. The government has shown, this federal government, that it is not operating in good faith. And I'm simply leaving that comment to have been substantiated by other workshops. I hope it has. On April the 1st, there is a move for people to get together to insist that this government release the text. I hope that we all participate in that. We have not only a right to engage in nonviolent, mass, direct action, but with the government that is promoting the massive changes that it is with the FTAA, we not only have a right to stand up as a small group, as Robin said, quoting Margaret Mead, of a small group of people, concerned citizens that want to change the world. There is such a small group of citizens in a large number of cities across this country and in a growing number of cities around the world. And that small group today is not so small. We have not only a right to engage in mass direct action against what is being shoved down our throats in the FTAA. We have a responsibility to engage in it. We who live here in the North, the nations that are creating these, which will be the terms and conditions under which all humanity will be subjected. Provisions that didn't make it through the WTO are there in the FTAA. And once they're established in the FTAA, that will be a jumping board to ensure that they will also be in the WTO for the planet. And I would encourage you all to look inside, to try to assess what you consider the real values are when you have a conversation between you and you, and decide for yourself your own course of action around the FTAA.
That was Bob Everton of the BC Latin American Congress.
Anarchy in the Air as Summit Draws Near by Allison Haynes of the Montreal Gazette. So what's it going to be then? The famous opening line of Anthony Burgess's novel A Clockwork Orange neatly encapsulates the confrontation brewing between police and anarchists at next weekend's Summit of the Americas in Quebec City. With both predicting that if any violence occurs, it will be initiated by the other side, things could get ugly. Calling from his office at Yale University, where he is an assistant professor of anthropology, David Graeber laughed when asked how it feels to be the cause of the biggest security operation ever mounted by the RCMP. Graeber is an anarchist. In the past, he has also participated in Black Blocs, a confrontational protest strategy used at the World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service has ominously warned might lead to violence at the Quebec summit. But when Graeber talks, he's most polite and forthcoming. He returns calls promptly, he cracks jokes, and he explains the finer points of the anarchist philosophy patiently and thoroughly. Our long-term goals are pretty ambitious because we pretty much want to reinvent democracy and do it on a global scale, he said. We're trying to create alternative institutions that would make the state unnecessary. Graeber's casual, friendly tone tends to gloss over some of the more contentious aspects of this worldview, but he articulates anarchism as a political philosophy like any other, rather than some sort of scary antisocial behavior. But a lot of anarchist rhetoric found on the internet and in newsgroups is confrontational and sometimes downright inflammatory. Nothing ever burns down by itself, quips a banner on the popular anarchist website infoshop.org. Every fire needs a little bit of help. A little interjection here. Those words are actually lyrics from a song by the group Chumbawamba. But apparently the author of this article is not aware of that. Okay, back to the story. The RCMP are certainly worried. The presence of anarchists in Quebec is one of the top reasons for the 6,000 police officers, the arsenal of plastic bullets, and the 3.8-meter-high security fence, nicknamed the Wall. As far as the security measures go, it's the Black Bloc and others who espouse violence that most concern us, said RCMP Constable Julie Brongle. Anything that is going to put either the property or the safety of people, be they protesters, officers, or dignitaries, in peril is going to require our intervention. A recent Canadian Security Intelligence Services report about protests planned for the summit also raises alarm. Quote, radical anti-globalization elements, many with links to anarchist groups, will take advantage of the meeting in Quebec City to organize protests and to engage in violence. Anarchists, with their philosophy that justifies the destruction of private property, will draw disenfranchised youth to participate, unquote. Yeah, we certainly wouldn't want disenfranchised youth to participate, now would we? The Canadian Security Intelligence Services report continues, quote, the call for the organization of Black Bloc affinity groups and the presence of several radical anti-globalization groups increases the likelihood of violence. The use of petrol bombs and similar disruptive instruments by a few radicals cannot be ruled out, unquote. Black blocs are not formal groups, but informal groupings of individuals who come together at demonstrations, usually with an agreed-upon set of tactics. They operate secretively and are organized horizontally into affinity groups, which cooperate and make decisions about actions by consensus both before or during demonstrations. The affinity group members dress alike, sometimes in black, sometimes in costumes, to obscure their identities, but also in a show of solidarity. The idea being, quote, if you did it, I did it with you. It might as well have been me, unquote. Within each affinity group, roles and responsibilities are distributed. Each has a, quote, spoke, unquote, who meets with members of other affinity groups to present ideas, talk tactics, and build the consensus needed to make decisions. Other roles can include the medic, who is responsible for first aid and the well-being of each affinity group member, the supply person, and the legal eagle, who tries not to get arrested and who keeps track of who does. That person also keeps a list of whose dog needs to be walked if they go to jail for a few days, and whose mom needs to be called if they get arrested, Graeber said. He will not be participating in Black Bloc activity in Quebec City, but as a member of the Italian-based group Yabasta, a group that dons brightly colored protective gear and blocks roads. But he has been in a Black Bloc as recently as January. At the inauguration of George W. Bush in Washington, he and 600 other anarchists protested alongside disgruntled Democrats. The most radical thing we did was throw paint bombs at the Washington Post, he said. We thought it would be suicide to crash the parade route. They did storm the Naval Memorial, where the U.S. flag was ripped down and burned with the anarchist banner bearing the red Circle A hoisted. As Graeber explains it, anarchists see a future where the state is replaced by a network of communities, where decisions are made locally by consensus, and where borders don't exist. He doesn't pretend to speak for all anarchists or all sects of anarchism, but he is plugged into the community. And he offers an important insight into the movement, because he is the only anarchist who would talk to the Gazette for this story. Anarchists draw many of their ideas about democracy from indigenous peoples, the Maoris in New Zealand, the Indians in Chiapas, the Mohawks in Canada. They try to cooperate using these concepts. Anarchists have become part of the so-called anti-globalization movement because they too are concerned about the lack of democracy in international institutions, even though they reject their legitimacy. We say, if you want to globalize, let's do it, but let's really do it and get rid of all the borders and national governments, Graeber said. Black blocs are a strategy often employed by anarchists, but other groups form them too. Tactics are not set in stone, but depend on a given situation. They can include, quote, unarresting, unquote. When police try to grab someone and haul them off, the black bloc will try to grab them back, Graeber said. Some but not all actions involve property destruction, usually of corporate targets. In an international system founded on the pursuit of profit, we find our most effective action is to attack oppressors where it hurts most, their wallets, reads a communique from the anti-statist Black Bloc out of Philadelphia, dated August 9, 2000. Black Bloc followers adhere to a moral code, Graeber said. They make distinctions between private and personal property. They also might smash the window of a police cruiser as long as no one is inside, but not the windshield of a private car. They do not consider vandalism to be violence. There's a detailed code of ethics. People think very hard ethically about the actions they do, Graeber said. Most of them are vegans. They wouldn't step on a worm. The blocks hate predictability and try to be creative about their strategy. Black blocks were formed at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings in Washington, D.C. last year. A softer approach was taken after the Battle of Seattle in 1999. That's when black blocks first popped up on the cultural radar, although they date back to the Gulf War in the U.S. and as part of a squatters movement in Germany in the 1980s. After days of peaceful demonstrations, badly outnumbered Seattle police clamped down with tear gas, spurring the black blocs into action. They smashed store windows and looted one Nike Town outlet, threw eggs filled with glass etching solution, and spray-painted city benches and garbage bins to the horror of more peaceful protesters who formed rings around stores and even tackled black bloc practitioners to the ground. For a time, there was a rift among anti-globalization activists, but successive demonstrations where police came down hard and heavy have united protesters. Leading up to Quebec, no protest group with which the Gazette spoke would denounce another strategy, and they all blamed baton-wielding police for the outbreak of violence at past world meetings. The specter of violence may again depend on police. A declaration on Infoshop.org, dated March 28th and signed by seven groups, including Group Anarchiste Émile Henry in Quebec City and La Main Noire in Montreal, states, "We shall respect the spirit and parameters of this rally, organized by various unions, non-governmental organizations, popular groups, women's groups, and student associations. Unless attacked by the police or the security forces, which could require us to defend ourselves, we shall remain nonviolent during this event." Constable Brongle of the RCMP calls the declaration a hopeful sign about the tenor of the demonstrations, and said she hopes the anarchists stick to it, but she vehemently rejected the idea that police could instigate violence. Through their training, officers are taught to be very calm and very tolerant, and to make a distinction between protest and illegal acts, she said. Officers will be there to intervene if there has been an infraction of the law. Graeber offered this observation: all the coercive force needed to keep order is a result of having the coercive force in the first place. If they'd said, "Do what you like," the worst that would have happened is we'd be doing a blockade. And that was Anarchy in the Air as Summit Draws Near by Allison Haynes from the April 13, 2001 edition of the Montreal Gazette. Lawyers Shun Summit, Prosecutors Say They're Being Used to Control Protest by William Marsden from the Thursday, April 5, 2001 issue of the Montreal Gazette. Quebec prosecutors are threatening to quit a special 8-member team set up by the provincial government to prosecute protesters arrested at the Summit of the Americas this month. They are objecting to what they claim is political interference with the judiciary on the part of the summit organizers. One prosecutor has already left the team, and others are expected to follow. Prosecutors say Provincial Justice Minister Paul Bégin has directed them to delay all bail hearings of arrested protesters for the maximum 3 full days allowed by law, as a way of keeping them off the street for the duration of the summit, April 20th to the 22nd. "This is political interference, and we should not stand for it," said one prosecutor who did not wish to be named. "It's a plan of battle to hold them in jail. We will not accept these directives." The criminal code allows bail hearings to be delayed for a maximum of 3, quote, "clear days," unquote, between the day of the arrest and the day of the hearing. This means that protesters could find themselves behind bars for 5 days. Normally, defendants are processed within 24 hours of their arrest. Often, they are released the same day from a police station with a promise to appear in court. Prosecutors also say that they do not want to prosecute people who are protesting against repressive governments represented at the summit. The Quebec government has built a concrete and chain-link fence around a large section of the old city where the summit is to take place. About 25,000 protesters are expected to show up. Jails have been cleared, and thousands of police officers from the Montreal Urban Community Force, the RCMP, and the Sûreté du Québec are being brought in for security. Prosecutors say they have been told not to subpoena police as witnesses during the week of the summit because they won't be available. Prosecutors noted that the criminal code allows them to seek publication bans on all bail hearings. One prosecutor said he believes that after the 5 days of incarceration, charges will simply be dropped in most cases. He said the provincial government is just using the judiciary to keep protesters off the streets. Montreal prosecutors plan to make public within the next few days a letter of solidarity with the protesters, one prosecutor said. Prosecutors are negotiating with the province for better salary and working conditions. Quebec prosecutors work in extremely difficult conditions. Most do not have computers. 85 prosecutors in Montreal share 4 secretaries, while Bagan, as justice minister, is paid $14,496 more than his Ontario counterpart. Quebec prosecutors are paid about half as much as Ontario prosecutors. Since the Gazette reported on the poor conditions last month, Bagan has promised to get the prosecutors' computers, but he refuses to connect them to the internet because he claims it's too expensive. That means they won't have access to online jurisprudence. Prosecutors complain that they have no time to prepare files and have to plea bargain more than 90% of their cases. And that was Lawyer Shun Summit by William Marsden from the Thursday, April 5th, 2001 issue of the Montreal Gazette.
Our next speaker is Miriam Palacios, who will speak on the effect of the FTAA on women. Miriam is the Basic Program Coordinator of Oxfam Canada. Oxfam is an international development and human rights organization that supports programs by local communities to help people meet their basic needs. She is originally from Guatemala, and she has been active as an advocate for social justice causes in both Guatemala and Canada.
Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I would like to start by thanking the organizers of this very important event, the members of the Mobilization for Global Justice Vancouver. Indeed, all of you deserve an incredible applause and congratulations for all the efforts that you have put into this important event. I'm going to be talking a little bit about what is happening in terms of these issues of international trade, the FTAA, what is the situation confronted by women. Trade programs, as seen in the discussion surrounding NAFTA and the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the World Trade Organization, have generated considerable national debate and media attention, as you all know. However, women's concerns, particularly those of women in developing countries, have seldom been represented. Indeed, many government officials, trade negotiators, and policymakers alike do not perceive trade to be an issue that impacts women. And you can realize this just by looking at any literature and see if you can find any reference to women. You might be wondering, why is this so? Well, trade rules are based on traditional neoliberal economic theories and macroeconomic policies that are gender blind and fail to take into account women's unpaid household work and unequal access to resources such as credit, land, education, and health services. At the global level, the United Nations estimate that women's unpaid labor is equal to $11 trillion a year. This unpaid labor, maintaining the household, caring for children and the elderly, and building community ties, is extraordinarily valuable, as you will imagine. That fact, or the fact that women's contribution is unrecognized in the market, leads to women being overworked, exploited, and very often marginalized. Failure to recognize women's unpaid work affects women's opportunity in public life, their status in society, their social development, and in some cases, their ability to fight for their very human rights. Why then is trade a women's issue? Let me give you a little bit of information about that. Trade is a women's issue because if you were to take and look at the clothing that you're wearing today, your blouse, your t-shirts, or whatever you're wearing, you will realize that most likely any one of the garments that you're wearing today was made by women. Probably your shoes were sold by East women in Asia, or probably a woman working in one of the maquilas in Guatemala, Salvador, Mexico, or Nicaragua. I am not asking you to feel guilty about that. Again, these jobs have provided much needed employment and income for women, particularly for poor women in the Americas today. As you can see by these examples, international trade obviously could not happen without women's labor. That is clear. 90% of the 27 million workers in air export processing zones are women. Of course, this percentage varies from region to region, but overall, the figure is 90%. This is a substantial sum. Let us now see specifically what is the impact of the FTAA on women in Latin America or in the Americas. As definitely has been said and you have read, the FTAA will be affecting 34 countries in the region. It will reach 800 million people, most of whom are women, especially in the export processing, textile, and agricultural zones. For women in Latin America, international trade is only the latest phase in the more than 500 years of underdevelopment and colonialism. While the phase of this process has changed dramatically, the fundamental interest of the colonial powers, in this case being reflected by multinational corporations, have not changed. The process of globalization, financial integration, freer trade, and investment has profoundly transformed the lives of women in the Americas. Let me give you some examples. All over America Latina, trade and liberalization policies have been preceded by national adjustment proposals, the privatization of state enterprise, the restructure of employment policies from secure employment to flexible temporary work, the relaxation of labor laws, the relaxation of tariffs and quotas, which leads to the opening of markets. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have created an unjust package of neoliberal policies known as structural adjustment policies that have been imposed as a model on poor countries in developing nations. As a result, women in the Americas, both in the North and in the South, have seen their wages decline and their workloads double because of trade liberalization. Yet, women are not only affected by global trade rules, but they are also affecting the process of global trade by the way in which they participate, as workers, as producers, and consumers. However, the ways in which they participate are affected, as you will imagine, by class, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, religion, and other aspects of identity such as nation and gender. In many ways, globalization and freer trade have exacerbated existing gender inequalities and deepened asymmetrical power relations between men and women in the whole hemisphere. Now you might be wondering, is trade good for women anyways? Is trade doing anything good for women? Some people will argue, yes, that some women have benefited. And in fact, some business women in the North are actually actively participating in the negotiation of trade agreements. Other women, and you will hear later on from our other panelists, have gained employment opportunities and income and some level of autonomy from working in export processing zones, which are all over Latin America. However, the benefits of global trade have not been evenly distributed. Although women comprise nearly 80% of workers in export processing zones, they are paid 20 to 50% less than men working in the same zones. Work at many of these exporting zones often involved long hours and harsh working conditions. I'm not going to elaborate very much on that because the next speaker will. In addition, these women have multiple roles that they must fulfill every day as mothers, as wives, as workers, as neighbors, and daughters. Most women work at home, cleaning, cooking, caring for the children, as well outside of the home, most often in the informal sector. In some countries, and for you who have traveled in Latin America, have realized that women are responsible for the production of food for subsistence of the family, particularly in rural areas. In other cases, women are traditionally responsible for taking items to be sold at the market. In reality, what is happening is that women are balancing their productive and reproductive roles by working in the informal sectors, selling crafts or food at the market so that they can care for the children and family while they work. Much of the successes of export-oriented growth is due to the large influx of women workers. Yet, studies have shown that the transition to market economy is associated with a rise in occupational and sectoral segregation by sex. In export processing zones, women workers represent approximately 90% of the workforce, although in some high-tech factories, women are being dismissed and replaced by male workers. In Chile, one of the incredible successes of free trade and globalization, in spite of government predictions of an increase in the diversification of employment, during the current decade, female labor is still concentrated in particular sectors of production. In agriculture, 5.6%, in textile and clothing, 9.1%, in retail trade, 18.2%, social and community services, 18.4%, and in the personal and household services, 23%. In other words, in Chile, 5 sectors of production account for 75% of total female employment. Moreover, those sectors correspond to the lowest salaries and least protected jobs. 2 kinds of jobs particularly affect women's conditions, household work and seasonal work, labor. There is in Chile more than 200,000 women working as temporeras or seasonal workers in the export agriculture sector. The use of toxins and pesticides is generating high levels of illness, which go very often unrecognized as consequences of women's precarious working conditions in these sectors. As you can see, export-led growth strategies promoted in trade agreement in the Western Hemisphere employ a largely female workforce in low-paying, laborious, and precarious jobs. Women work as many as 50 to 80 hours a week and earn just 56 to 70 cents an hour, if they're lucky. These wages are often below the national minimum wage and are far below what a worker needs to provide for their basic food, of housing, shelter for a family. Despite national economic growth in Mexico, Chile, and other Latin American countries, again, wages have fallen, and that is affecting most of poor people and women in particular. At this point, as you know, trade negotiations are drafting investment rules that do not take women's special needs into account. While the investment rules of the FTAA are not yet complete, FTTA negotiators are drawing upon existing language that is gender neutral. In reality, international trade and the FTAA reveal a policy of the U.S. government and transnational corporations to convert, in this case, Latin America and the Caribbean into a single market to serve best the interests of multinational corporations and the expenses of the poor. Yet, 2/3 of those poor people are women. Women's very poverty means that they are often overlooked by policymakers who are focused on big opportunities for expanding international trade. want to give you very quickly an example of one of the industries that best illustrate the way this liberalization of the economy through trade agreement works. And one of these industry, and the next speaker will be adding more, is the garment industry. According to a study done by the Centro de Estudios y Análisis in Costa Rica, there are over 200,000 workers in Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras, and Costa Rica itself working in maquila factories. Maquila factories being those maquilas that produce garment for export. Like maquilas working in Mexico, workers in Central America, maquilas, tend to be young women between 14 to 25 years old. 90% of them are women, and single mothers are up to 40%. They again work very long days, and health and safety conditions lead to dangerous situations. There exist numerous violations of labor and human rights, and often workers are unable to unionize, like the recent case with the Duro workers in Mexico. In Guatemala, just to give you a concrete example, the garment industry increased its export from about 5 articles to more than 200 types of clothing in less than 5 years. The industry employs over 50,000 workers, of whom 80% are women. Annual exports in the garment industry are over 100 million, and the industry has become one of the leading exports to the U.S. after coffee, bananas, and sugar. Guatemalan workers are paid between $1 and $2 a day for a long work day, and often those days stretches to 16 hours. Workers are frequently required to work between 50 to 70 hours a week. Stephen Coates, director of the U.S. Guatemala Labor Education, said once that if the labels that we wear in our clothing were to say the truth, it would say, assembled by women pay $2 a day and deny their basic rights. In the U.S., textile journals promoting foreign investment rights advertisement about women in Latin America. And I want to show you quickly an example. For example, one advertisement promoting investment in El Salvador say, Rosa is more than just colorful. She and her co-workers are known for their industriousness, reliability, and quick learning. Rosa Martinez produces apparel for U.S. markets and her sewing machine in El Salvador. You can hire her for 50 cents an hour. The same advertisement was placed in a U.S. magazine the following year, advertising Rosa work for 30 cents an hour. And there is a picture that you can later on see in some of the tables about this advertisement, how women's work is being promoted in the North. Yet, there is another face to the whole situation of trade. And I think it's very important to realize that there is a movement from people that are moving from all these situations of the adjustments being imposed to us to a whole structural transformation. Yes, there is hope. Women in Canada, here today, in the U.S., in Mexico, and all over Latin America, are working towards a better life. Women's consciousness is growing in different parts of the world. There are thousands of communities, usually small in size and modest in their goals. These communities are the ones that are challenging the prevailing colonialism and as manifested in the current international trade trends. You began to see in Seattle that what people would like to believe as the losers are by no means hopeless victims of trade. In many ways, you are the visionaries for creating a system of equitable and fair global system for the future. As women, we see that we need trade, but not free trade. We need fair trade. Fair trade that holds the principles such as human rights, environmental protection, public health, and incorporate important concepts such as human dignity, sovereignty, and independence. Those must have equal status with trade laws, principles, and regulations. In the end, women are bringing more than their labor to the international trade agenda. We are bringing a vision of an alternative way based on justice, peace, and equity. In the end, the sexism, racism, and gender bias of international trade agreements must not go unchallenged. Together, Women in Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Central and Southern America, and the Caribbean, through the Hemispheric Social Alliance and other networks, are weaving the social fabric of a truly democratic society in which women's voice will be heard. Thank you.
And that was Miriam Palacios, Program Coordinator from Oxfam, Canada. The Summit of the Americas will be happening in Quebec City from April 19th through 22nd. There are a variety of ways to become involved in protesting the FTAA. For more information on the web, you can go to www.stopftaa.org. Find out about actions in Quebec City itself, as well as a variety of actions happening on the American side of the border, from Buffalo to Vermont.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle.